Microaggressions and Mental Health is a 75-minute webinar and discussion about the effects of microaggressions on people from diverse backgrounds. Featured speakers were mental health counselors Antonia Ramos and Michael Swan. The session was facilitated by Kevin P. Henry. Ramos and Swan deftly examined the various forms of microaggressions and how they affect people in various ways. In addition, the speakers discussed how to be an effective ally and recognize and call out microaggressions in the workplace and in our personal lives. Hit the record button. So I'm Kevin Henry, and my day job is coordinating the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Program for Volunteers of America, Western Washington. I'm in the behavioral health program, so I work very closely with a great group of counselors, mental health counselors, who most of whom work on our crisis lines. And we are, all of us in behavioral health, are always looking for new information, new ways to serve people, and new ways to understand people. And understanding people sometimes and wanting to get into maybe unknown territory can be a little scary sometimes because, you know, when we're working in this, in today's society, we don't want to say the wrong things. We want to say the right things, or we want to be empathetic, or we want to be sympathetic, or we want to understand why, I'll pick on Marsha. Marsha's got so upset at that comment that happened in the meeting. It's like, what's wrong? You know, well, I just said blah, 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 and now she's upset. There's a reason for that. And what we really want to encourage you to do is to take that step. That might be a little scary at first, but it's all going to basically bring us together, either as a community or in the workplace or in our personal lives. So in addition to working at VOA, a big chunk of my DEI career was spent at the city of Bellevue for 20 years, where I coordinated and managed their Diversity Advantage program, which is a great experience. And it's, I think it's in its 35th year now. Going strong. We have a couple of great speakers that I'll be speaking with. I'll be kind of interviewing, and then we will take some of your comments or questions in the chat. Marsha's been nice enough from the NAACP's Snohomish County to kind of check that out. And I did want to mention also that this is a partnership with the NAACP Snohomish County, in that I'm the health chair, we have a health committee, and in addition to various programs and events that the NAACP Snohomish County puts on, there's a big emphasis on mental health and health and really being able to educate the community, but also find out from the community what the needs are so that we can address those needs and be effective in improving the quality of life that people have. So one of the, you can't have much of a quality of life if you don't have good mental health. So we have two speakers tonight, Michael Swan, mental health counselor, and Antonia Ramos. And while I'll be asking Michael some questions that are somewhat specific to the African American community, and Antonia questions that are a little bit more specific to the Native American community, a lot of these answers to those questions are applicable in a general sense as well. But I really want to be able to dig deeper into the cultural histories of certain races of people in the country so that, again, we can have that deeper understanding of history, but also how history relates to the present. So I wanted to start off with Antonia Ramos, and I wanted to give you maybe 5 or 6 minutes just to introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about why this, about your work, but also about why this particular topic is so important.
Yeah, hi, thank you for inviting me. Like you said, my name is Antonia Ramos. I am a member of the Tulalip tribes, and I have my degree in art therapy specifically. Mental health has always been kind of like something very important to me. When I was a teenager, I used to work for the Tulalip Boys and Girls Club. And I just remember being a teenager and then like all of the other like little pre-tweens are just like, you know, learning to come to their own. And we were like just figuring it out together. And I I was able to be a part of helping some of the kids who had some disciplinary actions kind of like find some comfort by going to the art room or something a little bit like less stimulating. And it got into a place where there's one specific child, and it got to a point where they would come up to me and they'd be like, listen, I'm having a bad day. Can we just skip the whole me getting in trouble going to the front desk, and can we just go to the art room? And this became a habit where that this child would find me, would say that whenever they were having a difficult day, and we would go to somewhere quiet. And in these quiet places, we would kind of just connect over just talking, like what was going on, kind of like, you know, creating art. And I remember one specific time, I was like, all right, like let's have a little challenge, shall we? Why don't we have a little drawing off? And we'll create an image that we think represents us. And, you know, whoever can finish it fastest wins, basically. And this child created a dragon. And I was like, very fitting. I like it. You know, like snot-nosed little like 17-year-old me was like, that's fantastic. And this child looks at me and they're like, this dragon is me. And I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, I agree. You know, you got a little fire to you. And they're like, no, this is me because everyone thinks I'm some big, bad, scary person. And, you know, inside I'm just trying to protect what's mine, and I can't. They're like, my dad left, didn't say goodbye. And nobody told me why, and nobody's asked me if I'm okay. And I'm mad. I'm mad that I have to be big and scary. I'm mad that I have to be like angry because I can't be sad. Like, where is he? This little child looking at me, I'm 17. I'm like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I knew in that moment that my community needed something different because I didn't know where to send this kid. I knew that we had therapists on our reservation, but I didn't know anyone specific, anyone that I knew that I could trust. And I knew that this child didn't either, because they were coming to me at 17 years old in the middle of an arts and crafts room at the Tulalip Boys and Girls Club. And so I made the decision to leave my reservation, something that I didn't think I would do. I left my family and I went out into the world and I got my degree. And the entire time I thought of that little kid and I said, how do I make this easier for people like that kid? And so I worked really hard at making mental health indigenous, taking in traditional practices. And that's why I specialize in art therapy. I use art as a way to help connect to the innate parts of individuals who used art as a way to communicate before colonization was even an idea, before communication needed to be a thing. There's signs historically all over in different, you know, communities, and like art as a way of telling a story. And so that's what I specialize in. And the more that I kind of gotten into my career, the more I've realized how these little tiny things that happen, these microaggressions that seem like nothing to people that do not have to experience them, can embody a lifetime of hurt for somebody, some child sitting in the middle of an arts and crafts room saying, why isn't anybody asking me if I'm okay? Why am I just supposed to be this person that the world tells me I'm supposed to be? I'm supposed to fit into this stereotype because I'm male, because I'm brown, because I'm whatever I am supposed to be in their eyes. And I'm not supposed to be hurt. I'm not supposed to be sad by these things. But in one comment, they dehumanize an entire existence. And so that's why I'm really passionate about this topic and about, you know, mental health and about making sure that it is available to everyone. And anyone of any shape, color, size, however they identify. And that's me. I'm Antonia, mental health therapist. I currently work at UTUB in the counseling center, and I do a lot of Indigenous outreach for the Indigenous students on campus, trying to help them have access to a mental health therapist that doesn't feel so far away from them.
That's great. Thank you very much for that. I wanted to move over to Michael Swan. And tell us a little bit about yourself and your current work and how it relates to such an important topic as tonight's topic.
Well, thank you for introducing me. Yeah, my name is Mike. I've been a counselor going on 6 years now, licensed for going on 3 years now. Worked entirely in the King County area in my counseling career. I graduated in 2017. master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from Winston-Salem State University, historically Black college in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I do this work because it's something that allows me to connect with my community. African Americans are very, very underrepresented in Washington. And I see this as a chance to give back to the community. I see this as a chance to connect with my own past as well. I've had situations growing up in Arizona where I've had folks absolutely display microaggressions. I've had friends act that way towards me and just have very just denigrating comments. And, you know, it's really easy to get angry, right? It's really easy to get mad. And in our anger, it is valid, right? Our anger can be valid, but it's another thing to take action. It's another thing to make the choice to advocate for people who are going through similar situations and understand that justice is something that isn't just a buzzword. This is something that exists. And as a counselor, that's part of our credence, right? To advocate, to stand up for the needs of people who need our assistance. So I take this job really seriously, and I really respect what other counselors do. I'm always open to new ideas. I don't claim to know everything about counseling, and I definitely don't claim to be the one and only expert. I gladly refer and I gladly consult. I'm a big fan of what UW does. They're actually one of the first people that I ever consulted with when I worked at DESC, doing special pops consultations. And I really love what they do there. One of my former supervisors actually works at UW, Jim Lady. He's an excellent supervisor, works in youth inpatient. So really excited to be here, and really excited to carry on the legacy of people who have gone before me in the counseling profession. And, you know, one more thing I want to add to this. I was actually thinking about this today, about men of color in counseling. I think I can count on three fingers in the last 6 years that I've worked in this field, the amount of men of color, licensed professionals that I've worked with personally in 6 years of working in the state of Washington. And that alone, to me, is the reason why I stay on. We need more people like me. Well, maybe not exactly like me, but people who understand what's going on. And I'm really glad to be here and really proud to give back to my community as best I can. So.
Well, thanks so much for both of your introductions. And I mean, what you said, Mike, about just the shortage, I guess, or lack of counselors of color. I've worked for several agencies where people of color would come in and really need some mental health counseling, and we couldn't accommodate them. And in fact, what would happen is you'd have an agency where maybe there was a couple of counselors of color, and they were backed up for months because of the demand for it. So one of the things that I think is so important is removing that stigma that can exist in communities sometimes about mental health, so that we can hopefully encourage people or kids, even when they're in middle school or high school, to pursue this and not be afraid of it.
Yeah.
Antonia, I wanted you to, I had a question. I'm going to start off with questioning you here first. And it had to do with the types of first of all, maybe you could define microaggression just in your own terms, and then give us examples of microaggressions that relate to Native Americans or Indigenous people. I know that personally, one thing that I've always gotten riled up about, but I'd like more insight on, are mascots, sports mascots. And I remember that I refused to cheer for teams from Atlanta, Kansas City, and Cleveland up until recently, because I just said, wow, you know, I mean, it's like so much of history has been ignored around Indigenous people, Native Americans. And yet this is what I see when I turn on the TV. So maybe you could talk about defining microaggressions and how they apply to your community.
Yeah, I mean, microaggressions is like a term that's used or our like daily verbal and behavior, or things that we do that can communicate hostility, degradation, or negative prejudice, slights, or insults towards a specific group, specifically like minority groups. I do know that this term was coined for African-American and the Black community that were experiencing these prejudiced acts early on. And then I can't remember who did coin the term and helped us become familiar with it. But over time, they realized that there's a lot of microaggressions that happens in many marginalized communities, such as the disabled community, people of color, and like other similar groups that kind of fall into that category, people who identify differently than, I guess, like what society has identified as the standard norm. And so these are just kind of like the follow-throughs of the stereotypes that people end up getting placed into. And I think it's really interesting to be asked about kind of mascots, specifically because this is just like a portion of the microaggressions that I have experienced kind of in the Indigenous community. What I've seen, it kind of is just something that it's a part of the bigger whole that Indigenous peoples experience. I cannot remember where or who said it, but I know that there was a quote that I read when I was early on in my studies. And it talked a lot about how Indigenous peoples are not seen as actual people. They are not they're not real. And what I mean by this is that a lot of the quotes or kind of references to Indigenous people will usually have a picture that's black and white, very old, very distant. There's a lot of references to things that aren't real, like Pocahontas, these mascots, right? These are things that, you know, dehumanize an entire race. And this quote continues to say, until we are seen as actual people, nothing can be done. And these microaggressions are just kind of the continuation of that. And so some of the things that I kind of thought of is that, you know, like specifically taking the mascot as an example, mascots that kind of embody Indigenous character, specifically like Native American Indigenous peoples, is almost like a joke, right? There's a lot of flamboyant, kind of like cartoonized, just detached part that comes in from these things. And a lot of them have really kind of fun little gestures that come along with them. I know like back home, they have like the little tomahawk, and people would like do little signs, and it just kind of makes things not real. It makes Indigenous people not real. And it makes comments like, oh, like a lot of my friends growing up would hear constantly like, oh, you're just like my little Pocahontas. Takes away their identity, right? Like, oh, you look just like that mascot from that football team. Takes away their identity. It's really hard to continue to be an individual person when society doesn't let you be an individual person by these slight little things that seem very minimal to them. But it takes everything away from that person who's been struggling to just be themselves, right? In an instant, people will not see the fact that I've done a lot of work to become a therapist, that I do a lot of work in my community, that I am constantly striving to become something, anything for that little child that first got me into this career. And they'll just be like, oh, so do you get ready in a teepee? And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting way to greet me. Hello, hi. So I think that's kind of like when we talk about like mascots, when we talk about these things, I think it's really important to also talk about the other things. Like, how often are we watching, you know, people dress up as Indigenous people? How often are we referring to Indigenous people as Pocahontas, as some cartoon version of them that we've seen? And how often do we let that take away their actual identity of who they are, what they've done to kind of just exist and be a person?
And what type of effect can that have on an individual in terms of their mental health, or just even, I don't know, their self-image?
Yeah, I think that a better answer than what I could probably give is just to ask a question, right? Like, what happens to an individual when they are stripped of their identity? What happens to an individual's mental health when they experience shame? What happens to an individual's mental health when they are criticized, belittled, and dehumanized? What happens when they are made to feel lazy, when they're made to feel less than? All of these things kind of get wrapped up into the term microaggression. Everything that we experience through all of those things get wrapped up into microaggression. And to answer that question, individuals who experience those things experience severe depression, severe anxiety. Some can experience multiple avenues of abuse, substance abuse. A lot of different disorders come from that, and a lot of it can sometimes lead to suicidal ideation and sometimes even just suicidal attempts that become successful.
There's a lot of talk about and a lot of participation, and I guess I would call it allyism in terms of, and it's usually tends to be white allies, not always, but I've talked with a lot of those groups, and I always try and bring in speakers, really, especially if they're asking questions about a culture that's not mine or a racial group. But do you have advice for people who say, hey, you know, I understand that, you know, history has been rotten. These things have happened. These things are still happening. What can I do to educate people? Or I want to put on an event. How should I start? Because I'd like to give them some sense of guidance. And I think that, you know, sometimes you're well-intentioned, but if you don't have that knowledge, you don't talk to the right people, you can wind up, you know, having a disaster on your hands sometimes. But any advice for those people?
Oh, definitely. I think the four main things that I like to share with people who are experiencing microaggressions and or perpetrating microaggressions. I would like to start off though that all of us have biases and all of us can perpetrate microaggressions. Just because our skin color may be different or we may be part of a marginalized group does not take away the ability for us to microaggress another person. And so I think all of us can benefit from the first thing that I like to recommend is just pause, take a breath. What you're about to say, what you're about to do, is it going to add to the situation, to the person? Is it going to be something that would be common across the board, right? If it's not, that is okay. There is a quote that says your first thought is society. Your second thought is you. And so when we pause and we just take a minute, it allows us to be present. Is this something that we would want to say? Is this something that we would want to portray? And if it's not, that's okay. We just don't say it and we kind of move on. Kind of a follow up with that, like the second thing that I like to encourage people is don't single out one person. If you are interested in understanding more about a culture, a community, or any kind of population, maybe like not seek out the one person that you know from that community. Just because you have proximity to them does not obligate them to become your teachers, does not obligate them to educate you. And for this, I do recommend a lot of things. There's a lot of social media creators who speak on different social or different communities or different ethnic problems that I think would be far better use of our time. My friend one time said, is this a question that you can Google? So rather than seeking out the one person in the room who aligns with the community that you would like to know more about, can you Google it? Can you find a creator to help you first understand and create empathy before singling out that one person? And the third thing that I like to point out is the singling out of one person. A lot of times our microaggressions are not things that we knowingly do. So there might be one person that we're like, oh, shoot, we should probably make sure that they're comfortable. And you're constantly going and saying like, hey, are you comfortable if we talk about this? And then the question gets asked, like, have you done that for everyone? Or did you specifically do this because I'm different? That microaggression is really, really important because it is not out of a place of malice or harm. You are literally trying to make somebody feel comfortable. But in doing so, you told them that they were different than the rest of the group. And the last thing that I like to encourage people to do is make it personal. right? When we are about to do something, we're about to experience something, share something, any of these things, would we want somebody that we truly care about to experience that? If we're going to make a comment to somebody, would we want our child to hear that comment? If we are about to present something, would we want our mother to hear things like that said to them? Just make it personal. And kind of, I think that really does cultivate the empathetic environment that can help us kind of overcome these microaggressions and overcome our continuation to single out individuals for either for us to become, educate ourselves or for us to become familiar with an area. And you asked the question, how do we find people to kind of help us? One, like I said, social media is a really good place for us to kind of get our footing in. And another thing is just create genuine relationships with people. When we genuinely want to get to know an individual, like, and we want to get to know how to assist, I think that's going to make a difference than if we're doing it because we feel obligated or because it is like part of our to-do list.
Those were all great. And I've been fortunate even working at VOAWW to have relationships and cultivate relationships with coworkers who are from much different backgrounds than my own. And I feel like it's a gift, really, that I'm receiving. Thank you very much for that. I wanted to move over to Michael Swan, your turn. And I have kind of the same series of questions, but I guess I'm also thinking in the last 3 or 4 years with the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, a lot of, how can I put it? A lot of maybe pre-existing racism that was always kind of simmering below the surface came bubbling up. And then, you know, people were unfriending each other on Facebook and saying, wow, I had no idea that Mike felt that way about Black people or whatever. So I'm just wondering, you know, what's your, you know, how do you define microaggressions? And maybe just give me some examples of how you've seen that play out in your personal life, but also as a counselor talking with some of your clients.
Well, I first off, thanks for asking the question. Now I've done a seminar on this before with you, and every time we have this topic, I always try to do as much research as I can, because the last thing we need is someone who's not educated on this topic from a clinical perspective as well as a personal perspective. So there's two different perspectives, and oftentimes they don't align. But one thing that I'm looking at in my research here, when we talk about microaggressions themselves, we talk about subtle denigrating messages towards a particular group, right? And this term was coined by Chester Pierce in 1978. So this isn't a modern day topic. This isn't something that just showed up on TikTok last week. This has been around for almost 45 years. You know, this is something that's been going on, and it has been coined, at least put in existence in the last 45 years and defined. We know it's been going on well before that. So we talk about covert and subtle racial remarks that maybe the person who did them wasn't really even intending to, you know, to be negative towards someone or to speak out on someone's stereotype in a negative manner or even a positive manner, right? So there are people out there, like, for example, with the Asian population, the stereotype of, oh, Asians are good at math and things like that. Oh, how'd you get to be so good at math? That is considered a positive stereotype, but it's still a stereotype, right? They're good at math because they studied and they worked hard. It's not necessarily because of their race. So we have to be able to be mindful of stereotypes and how microaggressions are kind of the windows into that stereotype. I've heard this, there's plenty of TED Talks on microaggressions. They talk about death by a thousand cuts, right? Now, one or two may not seem like a big deal, but when you have to deal with this on a daily basis or a regular basis, and I just recently did a webinar with you that kind of spoke to that fact from VOA, and we can't really get into the particulars there, but that's definitely something that is going on in organizations. Definitely something that I've experienced in my own clinical practice, both as a nurse and a counselor. I've been a nurse for 13 years, counselor for six, and there's definitely a an assumption of just because you're a clinician, that means you're not human, right? And they can kind of take that and just kind of take advantage of that and be very dismissive and questioning. And that's something that you see as a clinician of color. I'll often have white clients that will question my credentials, question my methodology, question my mode, and I have a very eccentric style, meaning that I don't stick to one style. I use multiple styles in my counseling. And a lot of clients that are white, they might question that. They might question, oh, where did you get, what is an HBCU? I get that a lot too. What is a historically Black college? You know, historically Black college was created because they weren't letting us into the PWIs. They created it for us so we could have a chance at education. And a lot of people, they don't really understand what that is. So they don't understand what the merits of HBCUs are. They don't understand the merits of affirmative action. And when people start to question things like this, this creates what we call colorblind racism, right? And this is something that is definitely well in the news and well documented nowadays. I mean, they're trying to get rid of affirmative action for the most part. And I think that is definitely something that we have to look at, and definitely something that affects the total picture of what the system looks like moving forward. And I think microaggressions are just a window into that. It's death by a thousand cuts. If I'm having a conversation with someone and they allude to some sort of either negative or positive stereotype, and they do it in a way that is meant to be humorous or meant to be funny. I mean, there's all these meme pages and things like that. I was actually talking about this with someone earlier, the term basketball people. This is something that I'm seeing on Instagram a lot. And they're using that to describe Black people. And I'm like, what do you mean by basketball people? You know, there's a guy on Instagram, his catchphrase is, what do you mean by that? Right. And I'm constantly questioning that and thinking, what do you mean by basketball people? And it's such a subtle thing that you would not pick up, and yet they're leaving it right out there for you to see. And that is an example of a modern microaggression that we're seeing on a regular basis acting out on the internet all the time. So I think that for me, microaggressions is an indicator of where someone is on recognizing and appreciating someone's culture, right? If you are so in this mode of not understanding when something is affecting someone in a negative manner, when something is attacking someone's character, their culture, their history, then that needs to be addressed. That needs to be spoken out on. And, I think the problem is if we don't speak out on this, we get the situations on the internet. We get all these videos. We get the Karen situations, you know, people calling 911, you know, just because a Black man is walking their dog and things like that in Central Park and things like that. You know, we get things like that. And that's what leads to even more significant conflict. So to answer your question, yes, I have seen it in my personal and professional life. I've had people literally drive down the street, and this is what they call it a micro assault, where someone uses blatant racial epithets. Mm-hmm. And I've had that happen to me in high school. I was going to school and a guy drove by in a truck and he called me the N-word, just right out and out, just yelled it out. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to school with that. And you know, freshman year, I'm 36, that was 21 years ago. I still remember that.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you, because I asked Antonio that as well, is the effects, the cumulative effects that it has on people. Because, you know, you were talking about the whole thing with the credentials, for instance. And I've heard from a lot of Black people in particular about the old saying of, you have to be twice as good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're constantly having to prove yourself or validate yourself because, well, you went to a certain college.
Yeah.
Or I remember a case one time where there was a white family, I don't know if it was in Seattle or somewhere else, but they didn't want their kid to attend a school named after Dr. Martin Luther King. It was like Martin Luther King Middle School or whatever it was, because that later on wouldn't look as good on college transcripts or something, or applying for college is what it was. So there's all these little things. I mean, I think of some of the the dismissiveness of even Confederate statues, things like that, you know, is that what I tell people is that, look, you know, you can interpret a statue any way you want, but different people interpret statues in different ways because they represent different things. So for me personally, somebody says, I always correct people when they say our founding fathers, because they were not my ancestors' founding fathers. They were slave owners for my ancestors. So that's how I view them. That tag will always be with all of them. George Washington, Jefferson, all of that. But we constantly get that rammed down our throats, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, and had I not gone to an HBCU for my undergrad and grad school, I would have never known that George Washington owned 317 slaves. Mm-hmm. Never would have known that. Never would have known that. They don't teach that in the PWIs unless you study African-American history specifically. And every class that I took in HBCU had some understanding of some reckoning and being able to connect to the real history, right? Mm-hmm. I would have never known about the Watts riots had I not gone to Winston-Salem State. I would have never known about COINTELPRO or Huey Newton from the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have known that, you know, one of our teachers was the head of the Black Panther Party in Winston-Salem. I would have never known any of that stuff.
Well, and some of that's regional. And I think that even for all of us, white, black, all different backgrounds, I knew about Huey Newton and the Watts riots because I grew up in Los Angeles. So the Watts riots were about 20 miles from my house. You know, I was a little kid, but I distinctly remember them. So I think that, you know, we had mentioned, both of you have mentioned unintentionally committing microaggressions. Mm-hmm. And it's just like I've seen people get in trouble for associating Black people with fried chicken and watermelon. Now, in some cases, now I know what that is to me. Mm-hmm. I go, you know, but I knew some people that literally there were white folks from Arkansas, and that's what they ate. So they said something about come on over to some, they said this to some Black people, come on over to the house and have some watermelon and fried chicken. And all the eyebrows went up and there was a problem. And they, well, that's what we eat. So I think that my point in saying this is that, what advice do you give to people? And I asked Antonio this as well. It's like, I want to be an ally. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I want to say the right thing. I want to be part of race and social justice. What's your advice to them?
Well, this is a good question. And I actually had this as a conversation, a clinical conversation. First off, education. You know, there's plenty of books out there that, and groups out there like NAACP that can allow us to raise the question of what is discrimination? How do we combat it, right? One of my favorite books that I always recommend to clients who are trying to, especially clients who are in interracial relationships and the topic of race comes up, because that often does happen in interracial relationships. The book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. One of my favorite books, highly recommend that book. I also recommend, like I said before, just social advocacy, right? We want to be able to step up and acknowledge where the discrimination is and be able to have a conversation on that is something that can give us perspective, right? And after the George Floyd murders in 2020, I was actually inspired to join NAACP. I was part of NAACP King County for almost 3 years. I was the health committee chair, and we did a lot of great work. And I learned a lot about King County and what the community needs. I'm currently a part of South King Emotional Wellness League, organization that helps provide free mental health resources for folks in South King County and pretty much all over Washington. And it's really woken me up to understanding what the community's needs are and how to reach out. So community activism, education, those are the first two places I would go. And like Antonio said, you know, asking questions to your family and friends, not being afraid to speak up when you notice something that doesn't feel right. You know, if it makes you feel, now, one of the big words that the kids are saying nowadays is cringe, right? If you get that cringe, right? If you're feeling that cringe, it's okay to speak up and say, hey, what, just like Drewski said, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. Right? What do you mean by that? What can you do to clarify, right? In DBT, they talk about the concept of mindful attention. And what that means is when we notice something is off and we need clarity, we take the time to ask, hey, I noticed this, this, and this. What can you tell me about that, right? We want to be able to raise those questions. And that's something that we do to help prevent increase in conflict. That's what we do to prevent unnecessarily violence, unnecessary conflict. We want to be able to speak up and speak out and advocate for positive social change in our communities. So that's where I would start. Education, advocacy, and not being afraid to speak up when you feel something is not right, when you feel something is not, it goes against your values, what you mean by, you know, what we mean by just accepting other people as they are. You know, just like the motto in Aberdeen, come as you are, right? There's also a Nirvana song about that. Come as you are, right? Mm-hmm. If it goes against our values and we sense that, it's okay to speak up and advocate. We want to give ourselves that permission to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wanted to mention, and please put things in the chat. I see a little message from, Marsha was putting about membership meetings. Yes, please check us out at the NAACP Snohomish County at our general membership meetings. But I know that people are, I can hear the brain cells, you know, moving around in the head. Please put things in the chat, questions, or just even a comment. It helps when we can share mutual experiences, because very often this time of year is when families get together. And you have the Thanksgiving dinner, you have the Christmas dinner, and then, oh my goodness, Uncle Albert's coming, and you know, he's a racist, and I'm hoping that he doesn't say anything in front of my Latino boyfriend that I'm bringing to the family dinner. So if you have any of those types of experiences, how to handle those experiences is very key, because if something goes down at the Thanksgiving dinner, for instance, and nothing is addressed, and especially if you have kids, younger people, and the kids are going, oh, wow, this, you know, Uncle Mike just said this to Uncle Bob and nobody did anything, then now you've got kids that can be confused and can also kind of regurgitate what they've heard at home as well. Yeah. So one thing that I think is so important is to be able to normalize the conversation so that the race topic doesn't have to be this, you know, anxiety filled, you know, hand wringing type of experience when something comes up. Antonia, I wanted to ask you, because both of you have mentioned education as something that's key. And I know there's a movie out now with Robert De Niro and Lily Gladstone, who actually went to Mount Lake Terrace High School, I think. And so much Native American history has been ignored. I've learned more in the last 3 years than all my years in high school and college, just about the boarding schools and the Trail of Tears and all of that. And there seems to be this new, I don't know, attention or push to get it out into the public eye so people can learn about history. And this is also there to counteract efforts, especially from certain states I won't mention, to repress history and even ban books. So what's your feeling about the movies and this kind of new push to try and educate people about the history as well as the present when it comes to Native American culture?
I think this is a little bit heavier of a question than I think we realize, right?
I'm sorry.
No, it's totally fine. Because I think I have had many different conversations with many different, you know, people from our community, Native American individuals that I've met like along my way. And we all kind of sometimes tend to feel differently. Yeah. I will speak for myself when I say I think it's necessary, because like Michael had mentioned, if he had not been in a place to hear about his history, there might be situations and kind of parts of it he would not understand. And I think that has been as a whole where we have been with Indigenous history. I've had a lot of conversations with different people and they have absolutely no idea. I remember when the pipeline was going through and having a conversation with one of my roommates while I was in college. And they're like, why is it such a big deal? We need it. And I'm like, what do you mean, why is it a big deal? This is a home. This is land. This is something that is valued and treasured by people who have been the caretaker of this land for far longer than anybody knows, far longer than I can even understand. And I'm part of that lineage. these things are powerful and important. And so with things of like the Children of the Flower Moon and things of like, you know, the boarding schools and these kind of uncomfortable situations being brought back up into society, I think it is necessary to start, though it is kind of not always done in the most beautiful and elegant ways, and we're still kind of finding our footing. I appreciate that it is starting the conversation. I appreciate that I have friends who are finally like, look at me and they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, man, that's why it's hard. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so any more, let me see if we have some more. I would encourage you to read the chat, because I know Antonia says, you know, none of us were at the right space to feel racism or microaggression. You have every right to take up space. And again, I mean, for me, that goes back to kind of normalizing things. You know, it's like this, I've been places where it's a check the box situation. You know, we have our annual DEI mandatory training for a half day, and then they check the box and they don't even discuss it for another year. And while, and in the meantime, you have this, these simmering examples of microaggressions and racial slurs. And then unfortunately it takes winding up in court and shelling out several million dollars. And then finally they decide to have a full-time DEI program when it's been like a silent infection in their company or their business or corporation for a long time. So being very proactive is so important, just like your health, just like your mental health. Do you want to wait until your blood pressure has skyrocketed and your arteries are all clogged? Or do you want to start doing things now to make sure that you're healthy? Any other advice that, I'll go with Antonio first. In terms of your, I guess I'm in looking ahead, are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Are you feeling like, okay, in order to make sure that we keep pushing the needle forward, what do we have to do?
I definitely lean more towards optimism because of the breed of people we have. And I'll share an example of a friend. While I was in college, my friend Edith identifies as a Black woman, and I were like one of like two of three people who were of color in this program, which is totally fine. That happens, right, when you go to, you know, big universities. And I remember there was something in the slide, and it didn't sit right with any of us. And like, so we both looked at each other and we're like, what? And so she said, that slide is racist. It offends me. And if you are going to continue to teach this course and attempt to teach that topic, I recommend that you alter that slide. Mm. And then the instructor was like, well, what do you mean? Like, why, like, can you tell me what's racist about this slide? What can I do differently? Like, he's like, I want to make sure that this is appropriate and, like, you know, tasteful and like available for everyone to feel comfortable. And she simply said, it is not my job to educate you. I am telling you, I am uncomfortable as a Black woman sitting in this class looking at that slide. Mm-hmm. And if you wish to have me continue to pay attention, I encourage you to do some reflecting. And that is all she said. Mm-hmm. And so when I say take up space, we are all going to find our place and what that means on a personal level, in like in our families, like you talked about, at a larger level, like Edith standing up in class and demanding the fact that she's not anybody's teacher. She's going to let you know how she feels, and she's going to let you know exactly what it was that made her feel uncomfortable. But it's not her job. She decided that was no longer her job. And then you will have people who love to take on that opportunity to teach and educate. And so I am very optimistic because there are so many more stories like that, where individuals are taking up space, where individuals are saying things, where individuals like Priscilla sharing that here, that wasn't a small feat. I mean, a small task. That was a large feat, right? That was something that takes a lot of courage to even bring up. Because what do you do when you feel hopeless? What do you do when you're watching things happen? What do you do when your own identity is triggered? And you have people who say, I will no longer sit back and wait. And I think it's a beautiful blend of individuals finding their voice, finding their courage, and standing up, even if it's something as small as 15 people in the middle of a grad program. Edith made a difference on me, and I've shared that story in a lot of my groups that I've had, and she's made a heck of a lot of difference in multiple, like, African-American and Black identifying individuals who join my group. So, like, so often we hear of these things and how we have to just take it.
And well, like, yeah, you have to take it, and because people aren't ready, and you have to show them grace, which is kind of mind-boggling. Hey, Michael, so what are you thinking about? Thank you, Antonia. What are you thinking about moving forward? Because I know sometimes I've attended workshops, or people have attended workshops and gotten a lot of information to the point where, you know, their head's ready to explode, and it's all good information, but now they want to be able to do something with it. And one thing I suggested, because when I worked at Sound Mental Health for a couple of years, and I was working with counselors there as well, and this was right after George Floyd got murdered. So we had a lot of Black Lives Matter protests going on. You know, some of it became, you know, a little out of control here and there, but there was a lot of tension in the streets, and there were a lot of clients or people who were coming into the agency who were Black, who were feeling, I mean, some Black males in particular were having some issues just being around law enforcement, for instance. And so we had a lot of counselors that I want to do something, but one told me, I remember, she said, well, I don't feel comfortable out marching in the streets, you know, doing the whole thing with the bullhorn and all that. But I said, there are so many other ways, and you've mentioned some great ways that people can educate themselves, call things out, find space for voices. But I've even suggested that at Christmas time or during the holidays, when you're buying gifts, buy gifts that are educational. I mean, instead of buying somebody a plant or, you know, a set of trays or whatever, why don't you, they have Black History flashcards, for instance. Michael, do you have some other suggestions for people?
So last year, me and my wife, we went to Bellingham to kind of give our dogs a break from the fireworks, because they're very sensitive to the fireworks. And one of the things that I wanted to do was research, because my grandmother, who passed away at when she was 51 in like 1979, she passed away a long time ago. She was a Cherokee Native American. So one thing I wanted to do was research some of the local tribes in the area. I've worked with folks when I worked at Kitsap, I worked with folks who were part of local Native tribes and Native American tribes. And so I did some research on the Native American tribes that are indigenous tribes that are present in Bellingham. We did some research on the Lummi tribe. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Again, you know, this is the American education system at its best. But and what I did was I went to the store and I bought, I tried to buy some books on and research the Lummi tribe, and they didn't have any specific books, and I was kind of upset by that. But what they did have was a book on Native American artwork, and that was for all the tribes in Washington. So basically what I did was I gave that to my wife as a gift, and we were able to kind of look into that and use that as a way to kind of guide ourselves in Bellingham and try to find a connection to indigenous population in Washington. And I think that would be a great gift to have, to understand the story, understand the history of indigenous tribes in Washington, as an example. Now, as far as African-American research is concerned, and just kind of connecting with the African-American community, there is a community in the Central District in Washington called Africa Town. I had the privilege of going there and doing some grief counseling last year. There had been a shooting in that area, and I was able to, they invited me to go and do some grief counseling and talk to the people who had been affected by that situation. Now, obviously not everybody can do something like that, but it would be, I think, a good thing to think about as far as connecting to other people. How do I invest in these communities, right? What do I do to invest my time, invest my energy? Maybe I just go down to the community and get a haircut and just listen to the history, right? Even if you do something like that and offer that as a gift, I think that's a good way to connect to African-American community rather than, you know, just going to a movie at Alderwood Mall or something like that. I think that would be a good alternative activity to participate in and in, actually invest into that community, because I think that that goes a longer way than just kind of, otherwise. So that would be my recommendation. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because another thing I suggest to people is, and I think we, you know, we all live in our own little bubbles. I mean, I do. I go to the same Safeway. I get, you know, I pump my gas at the same Chevron, and we kind of, you know, it's a comfort zone that that we fall into, that I think it's just human nature. But I think that empathy can also come out by putting yourself in a situation that is different, that's new, and like where maybe you're the minority. Because a lot of people walk through life and they might have a smattering of diverse friends. You know, I got my one Black friend, I got my Asian, I got my gay friend and all that, you know. But go to go someplace and spend the entire day where you are the only person of your background as well. And just start to experience what it's like to maybe be the only one, or maybe where your language is not really spoken very prevalently in that area. And I think that that can create a sense of empathy with people, so that the next time you're having an event, or the next time a client is sitting across from you and they say, hey, you know, I'm the only, I mean, I go to Montana, I have grandkids in Montana, I can spend a week there. I saw one Black person the last time I was there. I was shocked, you know. But it's definitely not my comfort zone, but the people that I run into don't necessarily know that. I haven't had a problem, except I did see a Confederate flag there one time, but that's another story. But what I did want, I wanted to start with Antonia for a second, because you started off by talking about your art therapy and using art as a way for people to get in touch with inner emotions. What advice, and I'll start with you, Antonia, and then over to Michael, for clients that come in that are suffering from that 1,000 cuts, and they're saying, I don't know, my self-esteem is this, and I don't, you know, I'm feeling anxious. Art therapy is one tool. Are there other things that you do, Antonia, when you're working with some of your clients?
I think that this question is also one of, I think the more that we kind of get into these topics, we realize that it's really hard to kind of give a general response.
Sure.
Because I've had many clients come in with like, what do I do with this, right? How do I do it? And each one is kind of different. One of the things that I do definitely recommend is, and that I try to assist them on their journey, is reaffirming their own identity, acknowledging and accepting the parts of them that they've honestly had to almost kill off in order to survive in the world and the atmosphere and the spaces that they take up. One of the huge things that I do in my work is this process of reclaiming what was taken, what was lost. I have a specific client that I used to work with back in Florida, and they were like, you know what, microaggressions aren't even that bad. It's fine, I don't mind. And after some time, they came to me and they're like, you know, I do mind. I just don't have the space to mind. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to me when I actually acknowledge that it matters? And for the first time, they put themselves first. And for the first time, they had the option to even say, what can I take back that was taken from me through racism, through microaggression, through the loss of my identity, through the loss of the opportunity to be outspoken and heard? So that's one thing that I do recommend is what can you reclaim? What can you accept? What can you acknowledge? What part of you has just been kind of lingering, waiting to be heard, waiting to be seen?
That's a great answer. And one thing I did want to mention to this entire group, everybody that's on the call, is that this is a continuous journey of learning that I like to call it, in that, you know, you have 90 minutes, you have an hour, you have, sometimes I've done breakout sessions that were half an hour, and we're talking about some subjects where you could literally talk for days, peeling back layers. And so what I'm hoping is that to see a lot of you on subsequent calls, this is like the third or fourth time I've tackled this topic, and I've had different speakers. Michael and I have done speaking before on this, But I would encourage you to, if you work for an agency or you are just an individual who want to know more, I put my email in the chat, but please contact me, because we can do this again. We can do this. I usually tend to do these things once a month. It's just the topics kind of vary. So my point is that please stay in touch and we can continue these conversations. But I think that was such a great answer about reclaiming what's and feeling okay with it, you know, because I think, like you said, I've had people who said, oh yeah, you know, I got called this name and this happened and that happened and, you know, it's no big deal. Yeah. And I'm thinking that, you know, it is a big deal. Well, first of all, it shouldn't happen. Nobody should be subject to that in the first place. But, and the fact that the weight is on you to deal with it, like, oh, don't let that bother you, Mike. you know, take the high road. Because yeah. Sometimes I feel like saying, you know, I feel like taking the low road sometimes. So Mike, what are your feelings about, you know, if somebody comes to you, a client or just a friend or whatever, and says, hey, you know, I'm really feeling kind of beaten down, or I thought it was okay, but I realized that it wasn't the way I've been treated.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of layers to that. I mean, you know, there's only so much I can do with a friend that I can say as a therapist, because you cannot be a counselor to your friends. But I am there to listen. I am there to provide empathy. You don't need a degree to do that. You don't need a degree to listen and use active listening skills, right? You know, you don't need that. You don't need a degree to validate someone's emotions and to sit with them in their pain. Right now, obviously, that a counselor is someone who does that, and I have recommended friends go see counseling, but you don't need a degree to do that, and that's definitely something that I do now. For me, someone who talks to people, you know, 8 hours a day plus, when I'm done talking, I generally don't talk to people. Like, what I like to do when I get off work is go do jujitsu and train and be on the mats, and that's how I talk. I talk with physical physical discussion, and but you know, every now and then I will have that conversation, like, what does this injustice look like to me? And I'm always the one to kind of advocate, hey, you have a right to stand up for yourself, you have a right to, you know, speak your mind. Now, right now, I'm dealing with a personal family issue. I have a brother who is in jail right now. And, you know, it's definitely hard for me, because it's like, I think about all the work that I've done in nursing and counseling over the years. And then I think about his struggle right now, his struggle to understand what's right, what he needs to go through to get out of the situation that he's in. And it's definitely conflicting, but at the same time, it's like, you know what? We have to be able to advocate not only for the rights of the people who are, you know, victims. We also have to advocate for the people who maybe they're not the victims. Everybody has a right to have their rights advocated for. And I don't know the details of my brother's incarceration right now, but I can tell you right now that, you know, it's definitely something on my mind. What is the just response? And I think that's a question that we ask ourselves whenever there's something that's ambiguous, like someone going to jail and things like that. So definitely something to keep in mind, for me, at least, and how I interact with people. What is the most fair response that I give someone in their struggle that I can give them at the time? And is there a need to pass this along to someone who maybe be able to give them a more nuanced response? Mm-hmm. So that's something to think about there. So,
well, I love what you said about passing on resources as well, because I think that sometimes I've seen people feel like they don't feel adequate or feel competent or confident enough to address something that might be a little bit out of their comfort zone or something they don't know about, but they can still play a role. They can still say, hey, you know, I don't know how to answer that question. I can't even begin to think what you're experiencing, but, you know, here's a group that you can join. There's movie groups, there's meetups, there's even when I was locked down, like everybody else for a couple of years, I met so many people online groups on Facebook. And even in this region, There's Change the Narrative Granite Falls is one group on Facebook. There's another group, the Edmonds Action Coalition. There's the North Shore group as well. There's Rise Up Lake Forest Park, which sounds like a science fiction movie. But there are people out there. There's even a website, and this is a national group of, I think they've got 40,000 members, called White People Doing Something. I don't know if how many people have even heard of that. You don't have to be white to be a member. I'm a member. But these people, they're great. They have Facebook Lives where they talk about issues. People pose questions, like they might say, hey, you know, this just happened in the workplace. I don't know what to say. Everybody kind of chimes in and gives suggestions. It's a very positive community. And what I like about it is that even though it has that title, it's really about everybody coming together. Mm-hmm. Because we all have a role to play. And that's what I tell people. Even if you feel like, oh, I'm afraid to say the wrong thing, I don't know what to say. It's what's in your heart that really counts. If you really want to make a difference, you can. And it's okay to reach out and say, I don't know how to start, but I want to start. So can somebody give me some advice or a direction? I wanted to, because we've only got about another 10 minutes left. If there's any more questions or just comments you want to put in the chat, there's been some great discussion there. And also, I know that Marsha had put something about our Snohomish County or NAACP Snohomish County. We have general meetings. We have all kinds of stuff going on. Marsha, did you want to just mention a few things? Because I know they've got all this stuff going on, Money Matters workshops, and did you want to do a plug commercial?
Sure. Some of these things are already in the chat, so feel free to look at the details. Our monthly membership meetings, open to anyone in the community. They're always on the fourth Tuesday of each month at 7 p.m. via Zoom, and the link's in there, or you can just go to our Snohomish County NAACP website and see details there. There's information about membership. There's information about a newsletter list. And to get on that, you need to scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page on the membership page. Mm-hmm. And we've got, we have a series called Your Money Matters. It's a financial literacy workshop that's several weeks starting tonight and like Mondays and Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And it's free and you can attend any of them or all of them. And we've sent that information out. And you can always email me at secretary@naacp-snowco.org if you have questions about any of those things. And we'll be happy to respond to you. I'll put that in the chat.
Okay.
Thank you, Kevin. And thank you for the guests who are speaking
tonight. Yeah, I just really want I your work. Thank you, Marsha. Thank you. Antonia and Michael, a couple of things I just wanted to throw out there for who's still on the call, and most everybody's still here, is that there are so many different things you can do. I know that I have been fortunate enough to, while speaking at one event, I've met people who are parts of other committees. And I remember I did a series of, we did two different movie, I guess you can call them, you know, movie discussions for a group of accountants, a firm here in the region. And they have a DEI, like a lot of organizations, they have the DEI committee or the, you know, employee resource group or whatever, but they wanted to view movies and then have a facilitated discussion. So I had them view the movie 13th about, you know, law enforcement and the prison system and systemic racism involved, embedded in that particular system. And then we also discussed Hidden Figures as well. And it was a great opportunity for them to view the movie, but then also share what they took away from the movie. Because that's the thing, what's so beautiful about art, and whether it be music, dance, movies, music, is that it resonates with people in different ways, but it's a great way still to bring people together. So I say that, all that to say that I encourage, whether you're running a business, you have a DEI committee, advisory board, or whatever, is think out of the box. Any way that you can bring people from different backgrounds together on an even surface where they can talk and get to know each other. A lot of times during that process is when a lot of those stereotypes fall away, because a lot of people, like I know a guy once, I was in a, it was kind of a, there's something called, I'm forgetting the name, but it's like an audio Zoom kind of thing. But we were having a discussion. There was a white man from Utah, I remember. And he says, "Kevin, I want to ask you a question. I hope you don't take offense." This guy's like maybe a white guy in his early 40s. And he says, "But do black people like to be called Negro or black?" And I'm like going, wow, you know. But first of all, I don't think I'd heard the term Negro in 20 years. But I said, wow, you know, where has this guy been, right? And so, but I wasn't offended because I could tell he was just, he said, "Look, I'm a white guy. I've never been around black people. I don't know any black people. I grew up in rural Utah all of my life. But I wanted to learn more. So I've been looking at listening to the speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in those speeches, he keeps referring to black people as Negroes." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, in that context, that's what we were called." You know, we went to this whole great discussion about, you know, just the name, the color, to Negro, to black, and, you know, African-American and all that. And it was such a gift, that conversation. But so my point is that sometimes it's easy to have those little triggers in all of us because we have our own biases, but we also have our own trigger points. And it's easy to go, "What in the world did I just hear?" But I just encourage people to dig deeper and say, "Why did you ask me that?" You know, because it's not, the answer isn't always what you might think it is. So with that, I'll get off my soapbox. Any other final questions, comments? I put my email in the chat. I would love to see, people are still talking. Oh, that's Michael Swan talking. I would love to see you all again. I know there's several VOA WW people here have been, so I'll be seeing them. But I guess we'll just call it a night.
Thanks for listening to All the Way Authentic. I'm your host, Kevin P. Henry.